2009. The first item on the agenda is House Bill 2334, and that is being pulled off the agenda today. The next item will open a public hearing on House Bill 2336.
And House Bill 2336 would allow for convictions under another jurisdiction's statutory counterpart to be entered into evidence in certain criminal proceedings. There is no fiscal yet on this, so it's here for public hearing only.
Thank you.
Mr. Berry, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brad Berry. I am the Yamhill County District Attorney and the Chair of the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. House Bill 2336 is a bill that was submitted by the ODAA, and really, in its simplest terms, I won't quite gauge it housekeeping, but it is very similar to housekeeping. As this committee may recall, over the last couple of sessions, there have been bills which have basically dealt with statutory counterparts, in other words, statutes or crimes committed in other jurisdictions that will treat those past criminal convictions in Oregon as if they happen in Oregon. So, for example, using convictions we talked about yesterday, a driving under the influence conviction, for the purposes of figuring out what your past record is for DUII, if you got the conviction in Washington or Louisiana or Oregon, it's treated the same for the purposes of a prior conviction. And we have had other statutory counterpart bills which have come up, came up in 07, to deal with those convictions out of state the same way we deal with those convictions in state. House Bill 2336 basically sets forth that for the purposes of impeachment, for the purposes of challenging a witness on the stand with a prior conviction, we have certain prior convictions which you can bring up for the purposes of impeachment and others which are not allowed. All 2336 says if you have an impeachable conviction in the state of Oregon, you can use it at trial. If you have the same kind of conviction from another state, it too is an impeachable conviction for the purposes of use of trial. It really is just that simple. It might be argued that it broadens the impeachment, but it doesn't really. It just says if you get the same conviction in Washington, you have to deal with it the same when you're on the stand in Oregon as if you got that conviction in Oregon. It really is that simple. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Yeah. Is this process being used in other states at this time?
Chair Barker, Representative Krieger, members of the committee, two things. Yes, I think it's not uncommon at all that this is in other states. I also might point out that most judges, not all, there are a handful or more, most judges in this state already believe that the statute 40.355 already believe that it includes statutory counterparts from other states. There are a few judges who say, well, I don't have that exact authority from 40.355 and will not allow it. So the short answer is most judges in this state are already authorizing this.
Further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2336 and open a hearing on House Bill 2339.
House Bill 2339 would expand the information exempt from public disclosure to include certain personal information of public safety officers, district attorneys, deputy district attorneys, attorney generals, and the assistant attorney general. Again, there's no fiscal on this, so it's just a public hearing.
And was this one he wanted to be last? Mm-hmm. Okay.
We did this.
Mr. Berry and Mr. Gardner, please. And just go ahead in either order. Identify yourself for the record, please, and proceed.
I'll begin. Thank you, Chair Barker. Again, for the record, my name is Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney and Chair of the ODAA Legislative Committee. House Bill 2339 is, again, one of the bills proposed by the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and this bill would prohibit the release of personal information which is held in the public record related to, primarily from our perspective, DAs and deputy district attorneys. I will tell you this impetus for this does not come as much from the elected methods as it does for our interest of protecting the deputy DAs who do the work in our offices. I will begin by granting you that we certainly take the issue of public records and access to public records seriously. As you are probably aware, currently in this state, any person who wants access to a public record and is denied that for most records, they petition the district attorney to rule on whether or not certain records are accessible to them or are exempt from public disclosure. And although I can't speak for all 35 of my other colleagues in the electeds, most of us recognize that the basic premise of the public records law is to allow access and to have transparency in government. However, throughout the public records law, and if you look at the list of exceptions in public records, it creates a balance between the need for a person to have that record and whatever other potential problem would exist for the purposes of giving the record. For example, criminal cases which are under investigation, those police records, once the case is over, become public records for the most part. However, while the case is pending and because it might compromise the investigation, those documents are not subject to disclosure. Now, this is a broader bill, and I grant you that, but this is a matter of safety. And when I'm normally before you, I talk about the issue of public safety. I'm now talking about a limited part of the public of the state of Oregon of about 400 to 500 individuals that this potentially could impact for the purposes of protecting their personal identification and their personal information. Actually 2 days ago, but it didn't go out until yesterday, tried to get some information from fellow DAs around the state about the type of cases that they've had where their deputies have been threatened. And I can assure you that deputy district attorneys throughout this state are threatened by people who they convict of crimes on almost a daily basis. Speaking personally, I had been in office about 18 months, and I had made the decision when I took office that I would leave my own telephone number published. Thought if constituents wanted to call, that would be fine. And I left it published until one night when I wasn't home, and somebody, I don't know who because they did not leave their name, called and threatened me through my stepdaughter, my 12-year-old stepdaughter. Now, my number at that time was in the phone book, and I had the ability to keep it out of the phone book, and I can assure you that now it is out of the phone book. Not because I care if they call me, because they can do that at the office 5 days a week, about 60 hours a week. They can find me in my office. I don't hide my personal desk line from anybody, but they can get a hold of me. But they ought not to be able to threaten my family. What happens in many of these cases are the individuals who are convicted of crimes, the last person they see as the person responsible is rarely the judge, but is often the person they've spent days with or hours with who has been pointing at them and pointing out their wrongdoing, and that is the deputy district attorneys. What I brought today are a few samples of communications that I have and stories from around the state, which I'd like to share with you, communications directly from offenders to deputy DAs. I'm not going to use the names on them. Several of these that I'm going to share with you include some very vile sexual references, which I also will omit from the record, dealing with sexual assaults which will occur before the death that they're threatening. But I'd like to share with you some of the communications that happen. The first several are from Multnomah County. Addresses the deputy DA. You have been found guilty in my court beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury, and I hereby sentence you to death by mutilation and cannibalism. Your remains to be found by or to be fed to inmates. Words in here that are misspelled, so it's a little hard for me. I'm sorry to present you with this, but I thought you might like to know how your death sentence will be carried out. The person appointed will come to your execution, and he basically identifies himself as the one to be the executor. And it's interesting that, in fact, he included what looks like a pleading, which is a judgment of conviction against her. Another deputy district attorney received this, and I'm only reading part of it. Did you think this piranha would just up and walk out of your life? Sorry, you're wrong. You ruined my life. So the only thing I got in my life is you. Deep inside that cold heart of yours, I will and warm you up and forgive you. But baby, you must die for that evil wrong you did to me over two lying alcoholics. Let me get to the nitty gritty. ... You are a dead woman walking. I will be having someone pay you a visit at your house, or I might wait till I get out and do it myself. If I don't, you will be dead in months. He goes on with a long dissertation of a sexual assault against this female DDA and finishes it by saying, "We'll be seeing you soon." The next one, again to another deputy DA, and I'm skipping parts of it, says, "I will make sure you die after my release from prison," and then has her name. "The same way me, the angel of light, told you, believe nobody can save you except my leave. Your husband, he will die soon, within the next couple months. I'm going to handle myself. I will appear in a dream to him and inform him why he's going to die. I have many friends that work at DMV. Phone number, addresses, the whole nine yards are simple to get. You drew first blood, not me. So tell me, Deputy DA, have one of your clients ever wanted to kill you? Well, I'm not even one of your clients, and I would like to see you dead, grave dead. How would you like that, Deputy DA, laying lifeless? I was thinking about you today. I was thinking about you and your family's addresses and the places that you hang out. I'm hoping to pay you guys a visit soon." After he has a discussion of weapons, he says, "But I'll make sure I have one when I come to see you. I'll have a nice weapon then. I want to see blood all over me." Another one. "I am going to do a bit of time, but I won't be in forever. Remember that. When I get out of prison, I will find you and put a bullet in your head. And little Susie, you will be no more. I swear in the name of Almighty his God, that this will happen. If I were you, I'd go into exile before I'm released." Another case was summarized to me of someone who was convicted in Washington County and actually set, this was a victim, and again, now this is public disclosure of all these records to anybody, a victim who was angered about a decision not to prosecute a particular case and threatened that they were going to go blow up a DA's home in another county that had some relation to that. Fortunately, they were stopped before they got out of the first county. Another victim was upset in relation to a domestic violence case with her husband. And the victim at that time showed up at the prosecutor's home trying to force her way into the home. She indicated when she was contacted by police that she got the deputy district attorney's address from the county records department. If I can give you one more example, and then I'll go on to the basics of the bill. A prosecutor, the chief deputy DA in Crook County, who is now no longer in Crook County, prosecuted a guy who became angered, of course, about being prosecuted, and plotted to kill this chief deputy DA. The plot went beyond just thinking about it. At 2 o'clock in the morning, he set fire to the chief deputy's house with the plan that as the chief deputy and his wife and his children left the house, he would be sitting across the street and shoot them as they came out the door. He literally set the house on fire, but fortunately did not kill anybody. He's currently serving a long term for attempted aggravated murder. House Bill 2339 provides for limiting public disclosure of the personal information of deputy DAs, DAs, and AAGs, and candidly, we would agree to limit that on AAGs to those that the Attorney General would direct, those who are dealing with criminal conduct. This is not a difficult or complicated thing to implement. The DA or any of the deputy DAs would have to make a request that their information be kept confidential. Most information that is contained in the public record is contained in computers. And I know that there will be discussion today about the difficulty of securing this particular record and not others. I am not a computer genius. I can secure any letter that I have on my computer from anybody getting to by password protecting it. I'm not saying it's that simple. I've checked with the IT people from my county to find out what would it take if somebody would say, walk in and say, tell me any information you have about addresses for Brad Berry. They could easily make it so that when that request is made, that it pops up and says non-disclosure. Additionally, I know that some older records are kept on Laserfiche, a further complication. But I am unaware of any system, there may be some, I am unaware of any system whereby the access to a particular chronicled Laserfiche is not directed by a computer. Again, the same process. And it can be done the same with my address or other information that somebody may walk in and make a request related to find me, or more importantly, one of my deputy DAs. I'm confident today you will hear, because I've had conversations with them when we addressed the subject before, from individuals from, for example, title companies, financial institutions, and the like, who may need to access public information for it. I suggest to you that their need to have this information is no different than the need in many different systems that we currently have. If I were to come to any of you today and apply for a life insurance policy, you likely are going to want access to my medical records. Everybody, I think, here understands that medical records are personal, are private. They're not contained in the public record, but they are contained in places where they're not disclosed. The way that, if I want to get life insurance, the way that I'm going to get that is to sign a release. I suggest that it's no different than anybody who's applying for a loan. Anybody who's applying to purchase or sell a house or get title insurance could sign a release which would allow them access to this information for those limited purposes, which is no different than a process we use commonly today. The difference is these are public records, and although we may not be used to having a waiver to get access to particular records, it certainly is not, I would suggest, a complicated process. There may be an issue brought up to that there's some cost. I don't know. This has not been vetted for a fiscal. I don't think it is a fiscal, a major one. As I've mentioned, I think it is relatively minor computer adjustments to lock down this information. But we think when we do it, as is done in the public records laws as a whole, we need to weigh the risk versus the general offset, one might be a slight cost. The life of a deputy district attorney or others doing that work versus the relatively minor cost of being able to secure this information. We ask long hours, we give modest pay for the individuals who are deputy district attorneys in the state. They are daily placed in the glaring crosshairs of defendants who are in court and defendants who they are prosecuted and will likely imprison. Some of those will act out against the person that they hold responsible for their conviction. That person, I strongly argue to you, ought not to be able to leave the courtroom, walk down the hall, sit down at a public access computer, access public information from the county clerk's office, and find out where that deputy district attorney resides and plot to kill them, or worse, actually carry out the threat. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Okay, please. Thank you, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Alex Gardner, and I'm a district attorney from Lane County. And I asked to testify before you today because I need your help, and I have a particularly compelling story to tell. Actually, I have two. The first involves a case that I prosecuted. I convicted a guy about 15 years ago of attempted murder and kidnap. Basically, the case involved an all-night-long torture. I won't give you all the gruesome details, but I will tell you that it was a particularly gruesome case that began with the criminal involved threatening to cut a spiderweb tattoo out of the victim's arm so that he could make a lampshade out of it. The guy that I prosecuted was a particularly vile human being who was tremendously dangerous. To put it in perspective, when he got, it took forever to get him to trial because he threatened to kill two judges. None of the defense attorneys in the community in which I was prosecuting the case would represent him because in prior cases he had threatened to kill them. Ultimately, an attorney from Medford was brought in to prosecute the case, and ultimately, after this individual was convicted, he withdrew from the case, and an attorney had to be brought in from Bend to try the case. There was a motion for a new trial on the case because after no time at all in custody, this individual had convinced several other inmates in the facility that if they didn't come forward and provide false testimony about alibi and other matters, that he was going to kill them. And even for cons who were fairly savvy with the system, they found it believable, and so they did come forward and perjure themselves in the interest of securing a new trial. On his way to prison, this guy made it very clear to everybody in the prison bus that he was going to return and kill the DA. He subsequently sent me multiple letters threatening, and I accessed his Department of Corrections records several years after this happened and found in notes in his file that he was continuing to, quote, obsess about killing the DA who sent him to prison. He represents a very real threat to my family, and he's due to be released from prison sometime in the next couple of years, depending on how DOC makes their most recent calculations. The more recent case involves one of the deputy DAs in my office. We had occasion to prosecute a man who had been convicted of murder, sent to prison, and while in prison killed another inmate. After serving that time, he was released to Lane County, where he went about doing what he does, which is to commit whatever crime presents. His favorite thing is robberies, but he's an opportunist and takes advantage of whatever there is. One of my deputy DAs prosecuted him, and while this, I don't know if you're familiar with Lane County, but we have a porous jail for a number of reasons. This inmate was released to the community pending trial. He went immediately from the Lane County Jail to the assessment and taxation records. There's a public access computer. He got into the Lane County records, got this particular deputy DA's address, and then immediately got a Google map on how to get to the property. He went to the property, including wandering around underneath the house in the crawl space, made a map, took down the details of the house, and developed a plan. His plan involved going to Walmart and getting a sprayer, like a garden sprayer, filling it up with gasoline, and then going into this crawl space that he had visited and spraying the subfloor of the house with gasoline, and then sitting across from the house with a rifle. By the time he started to implement the plan, he knew that our deputy DA had a wife and two kids, and he mused to his cellmate about how fun it was going to be if the wife or kids came out of the house before the deputy DA, because he was going to be across the street in the abandoned house, shooting them as they came out the door. He was ultimately convicted because of really good fortune on our part, because the inmate to whom he spoke in the jail was so disturbed that something this bad might happen and that it might involve the family of the prosecutor and not just the prosecutor, that he brought it to the attention of the correction staff. excuse me. The case was tried, and during the trial, we had this criminal on the stand for quite a while. He mused about how there are people in the Oregon corrections system and others that tell guys, basically hold classes on how you can use the computer systems that are public access to gain this information. This really is cons going to school on how to do what they want to do. And the deeds and records computer is just one floor up from our assessment and taxation computer. They're very familiar with the resources they have at their disposal, and our people are very vulnerable. Once the address is determined, as you probably know, you can just put it into Google Earth, and it gives you a map right to the house. This isn't just idle threats, at least not in some of these cases. To say that this was terrifying to the deputy DA and his wife and kids would be a profound understatement. I invited him to come up here because he could tell the story so much more effectively than I can. And he has a hard time getting through it. This is a guy who's seen plenty of murder and mayhem, but the idea of his wife and kids being burned out of the house and shot dead in the street is more than he can share. I hope you can help. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Morales, Ms. Coleman, and Mr. Roman, please. You can go ahead and end the order. Just identify yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed.
Okay. James Morales, Benton County Clerk, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks.
Bob Roman, I'm the Clackamas County Assessor and Tax Collector, and I'm representing the Oregon State Association of County Assessors and the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors.
Jan Coleman, I'm the retired Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, before I have provided some, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I provided some written testimony on behalf of the County Clerks Association. Part of what we're saying here is we'd like to work with the proponents of this bill to figure out how we can do it. Inside here, we also have a recommended solution that we believe would work immediately. Of course, one of the concerns that we have for the records that we already have on file is these records go out immediately. They're public record. They've been copied. They're in the databases of all of the title companies, a lot of escrow offices. And so they're already out. I mean, they're in multiple formats. They've been archived. They're in microfilm. They're since probably the 80s in most counties, they are electronic. Dealing with the electronic records might be a little easier, although there is a cost, and it would be complicated when you talk about somebody maybe giving you the names of the district attorneys, and that is the way we index our records. To remove anybody with the name of Joe Smith, we would have to... We wouldn't know if it was Joe Smith, the DA, or Joe Smith. So, you know, it is a complicated process proposal that we're talking about here. So we would like, what we're proposing here is that we get the opportunity to work with the proponents to figure out a better way to do this. I'll go through some of the things that have happened in the past. We've had an example of some restrictive legislation that has affected the public record. That took hold in Texas back in 2007. And I provided you a copy of the press release on the back of the information that the Texas legislature put out with what had happened and why they had to take the action to reverse the legislation, because there is sometimes unintended consequence for well-intended legislation. This is definitely a piece of legislation with good intent, but we feel it's too broad, and it affects all records, including the records that our local businesses are the very heart of our economy depends on, and that is the deed, mortgage, and lien records. And so we're asking you to give us a chance to figure out what type of amendments might be used. There might be alternative means. What we've proposed as an alternative means would be for the individuals that are concerned to take an assumed business name with the Secretary of State's office. Very inexpensive, easy thing to do. Utilize the DA's or the Attorney General's address on the documents that they record with us with the assumed business name. There you have anonymity, and the process is handled without any cost to the public. To the taxpayers to do that. And that's just a recommendation. You know, I'm not saying that's the answer, but it's one way that it can be done right now, mm-hmm. where no bill has to be passed, and these individuals can take a proactive role in securing their identity on any public.
So, thank you.
Just excuse me.
Well, let the panel go, and then we'll have questions if anybody has it.
Okay. Chair Barker and members of the committee, much of what I have to say reiterates what James says, but I'd like to assert to you that ORS 205-130 charges the county clerk with the preservation of our records and keeping them safe and intact. I quote, the county clerk shall have the custody of and safely keep and preserve all files and records of deeds, mortgages, real estate, real property, and records of maps, plats, contracts, powers of attorney, and other interests affecting the title to real property required or permitted by law. Right now, the public records law 192 and administrative rules that are set by the state archives divisions basically reinforce that statute. And they declare retention periods on our records, most of which are permanent. So with a permanent record, we are charged to put all these on microfilm, because that is the totally recognizable permanent record in the state. So if we had to do any kind of going back in the record for any of these, which, yes, a lot of it current is on the computer, but it's also turned into microfilm because we are charged with doing that. So it's not just on the computer. It's out on microfilm. Okay? So if we had to do something on the computer, we are going to have to do it to microfilm. We just want you to be aware of that, too. and to reiterate what James said, these records are daily passed to land records industries, title company people, and other ones associated with our industry. So we're just a piece of the pie. The record is widespread out there. So we wanted to bring that to your attention. The other thing I wanted to mention is, you know, in our day and age of computers, we can Google almost anybody. I found that out. I served on a statewide committee as part of the Clerks Association. And we were told one day by the committee members, she said, do you know that they can Google all our committee out there? So I went home and tried it. And indeed you can. I certainly was out there in all, you know, my glory with everything there. So the information is out there. It's just, it's difficult to protect it in all areas. And once we open this to one group, we face the possibility of more people coming forward. Some of you were in a committee this morning that we suffered because of that as county clerks. So I just want to bring that forward.
Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, again, I'm Bob Roman. I'm the assessor and tax collector at Clackamas County. Both the Assessors Association and the Tax Collectors Association are also asking that any legislation that deals with creating public records exemptions be directed into a work group where we can get people together and sit down and talk about the impacts that restricting information may have and whether or not there are other alternatives. Last session, there were a number of bills that were introduced to create public records exemptions on real property and taxation records. Out of that, House Bill 3407 passed, and the changes that you're seeing being asked for in 2339 are to the same statutes that were changed in the last session. So our members really think it's important, and it would be in the best interest of both responsible and efficient government, that we have a more global discussion about what records should be public records and include the stakeholders that it impacts, not only the proponents of this bill, but the people that rely on our information to do business. Because restricting name and address information, especially in the assessors and tax collector records, has a number of consequences. Certainly, I think a lot of times people will not be aware that it's the assessor's records that evidence or notice almost $4 billion in tax liens on an annual basis. These liens aren't accessible anywhere else. They aren't in the clerk's records. They're only maintained in our records, and they occur as liens by operation of law. Also, in our assessment and taxation records in Clackamas County, for example, we have 170,000 accounts. We maintain hundreds of thousands of records around this state that deal with name and address information. And as you've heard from the clerks, the magnitude and task of removing name and address information is not only daunting, but it could be virtually impossible to some extent, because those records are maintained in a number of different medias, not only on a computer system, not only on microfiche, but on hard copy, on disk, and they're in a lot of different, and they're accessible in a lot of different ways. So it's very difficult. And then selectively not disclosing information, either names in some cases and addresses in other cases, virtually requires us to maintain duplicate sets of records. So suppressing name and address information certainly does have a cost, and that cost can come in programming, processing, storing and securing additional confidential records. It also has the potential to adversely impact, and you've heard not only some other agencies, because there are agencies such as 911 that rely on name and address information that ultimately starts with the clerk's records, is maintained by assessors and tax collectors, and is distributed to a number of other agencies. But it's not just public sector agencies, it's the private sector. The banking and real estate industries both rely heavily on our records, title companies, escrow companies, and newspaper organizations all look to our records as resources. So there are a number of issues that come up with this legislation, and one also that is of significant importance is that it potentially creates some additional liability for our offices if this information is inadvertently disclosed. That was something that was addressed in House Bill 3407 last year, but it's not in this particular piece of legislation. And then lastly, I guess what I'd like to say, you know, very, very honestly, is there isn't anyone in this room that doesn't have the same sort of concern for the security and safety not only of our public safety people, our district attorneys, but it's the general public, it's our legislative body. Everyone that has information out there is at some risk. And so we don't in any way want to minimize that concern. But as you've already heard, a lot of information is already available and out on the internet. There are a number of sites other than just Google that you can put in a name and will immediately return names and addresses and telephone numbers. And so I'm not sure that this bill really provides the security that these people are looking for. And the way it's written, I actually have some concern that it doesn't actually provide less security than what they already have. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Any questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do hope that you can work with district attorneys and figure out if there's a way to make this work, because I do think it's an important piece of legislation. You said that there's no mechanism to shield the counties or your offices from liability, but I'm confused on page 5, line 25, and page 9, line 35. It seems to provide that shield from liability. Am I misreading that?
Representative Shields, would you?
I'm sorry, page 5, line 25, may not result in liability for the county if the name of the public safety officer is disclosed.
Representative Shields, Chair Barker, members of the committee, That's true, but that's applying to public safety. That's not applying to the district attorney. They've excluded themselves from that, it appears, and have added themselves in a different section under 32.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. Thank you, Pamela. And again, I hope you can get together with them. Since we're not going to work this day, there will be time to try to come up with a some kind of a workable solution.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Mr. Monroe and Mr. Snyder.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. I'm joined by Cleve Abbey, who is the Oregon Council for Lawyers Title Insurance Company, and who is, at least on a technical level, far more knowledgeable than I am. You know, we obviously feel the same way that that the assessor does, and that is that while we're going to express some concern about this measure and how it's structured, there isn't, I would guess, anybody in the room who is not concerned about Oregonians, and particularly public employees, being harassed or worse. And clearly the examples that were offered up suggest that there are many people in the system who are a couple of degrees or more off dead center. But I, and ultimately there's an interesting question, and again I think somebody who recently spoke brought it up, and that is the whole question of can you be an elected public official or a public official and then be and have anonymity after hours, and the reality of it is that that might be an unachievable goal. But this is the third session that we've dealt with this section of the law, and in the language that is kept in the current bill in Section 31 for public safety officers, it reflects, I think, a careful balancing, at least at the time, in 2007, of public records that should not be subject to disclosure in part, meaning the what we might consider personal information that's there. And I think the decision of the legislature in 2007 was sort of based on, one, the unlikelihood of certain records, namely the deed records, being used, and the complexity of attempting to block that kind of information from that set of records. And we'll at least briefly today touch on what we think the problems are. And so the problems, the concerns that we would have relate to Section 32, which is the section that that the DAs and AGs have offered up, the complexity and breadth of that that language. And I think it's also replicated later in the bill in a Section 31. And in summary, really, the concerns are, can it be done? And if so, what are the costs, both actual and in terms of opportunity costs? And there are some collateral concerns, and we'll attempt to identify those, too. I would say I listened fairly closely to the examples that were used, and I'm not sure that I heard anything about being specifically used, although I did hear a reference to proximity, one floor above, you know, there are some other records. But we're here, obviously, we're in the title business, and so we're directly impacted by anything that gets in the way of our having the information that we need. And I guess I need to remind you, although it was certainly suggested by those who preceded us, that almost exclusively, land and real property is not conveyed in this state without a title policy. And so that's a concern if you're concerned at all about the conveyancing of real property. And, you know, without going into a lot of discussion, you know, our mission is to evaluate title to determine whether or not the party or the prospective party who's conveying title, in fact, has the right to do that, whether there are liens or encumbrances or easements or a variety of other things that attach to that. And those are all things that not only the prospective owner, but the lender, the party who's going to lend money so that the transaction can be consummated, those are all things that are of concern to those parties. And the only way that we do that is to go back through the deed records and the lien records to determine whether or not there are encumbrances or other things that would affect the title to the property. It was mentioned earlier, I guess, that there might be some self-help potential, and I think the clerks mentioned it in terms of using assumed names. I frankly don't know how that would work because, I mean, we're looking for names as we go back through to determine whether or not there's been an encumbrance of any sort on the property. In many cases, even if there was the ability, and I think there is the ability to do a few things, not eliminate the name, but often on a deed or on some other documents, there is a, you know, return the original to and an address there. There's some ways I think you could deal with that. But there are some other forms that are out there that, such as a trust deed prepared by lenders and whatnot, where that might not be the case. We are concerned, I guess, with, and this is sort of in the can, in the cost, and in the proximity area, as it relates to documents, let's say, that are currently being filed, and one that, in most cases, it's only going to be an address, I think, that probably shows up in these documents, but the fact you also have, you know, electronic mail addresses and telephone numbers means that your screening process would have to screen for those things too. And I guess the question is, can you screen those things? The answer probably is yes. At what cost and how long will it take? And I'll get back to particularly the how long will it take issue in a moment. In the meantime, of course, until you've successfully done that, if in fact you're going to have to do it, you're going to have to deny access apparently to anybody, including title companies who download this information or receive this information on a daily basis. Now, because of course, you know, the address or some of this information also could be in previously filed documents, we then get into the issue that the clerks talked about in terms of microfiche. And if all you have to do is redact, that's one thing. I also heard, I guess, the word block used, which means, I guess, block access to the entire document. And that would frustrate certainly our ability to examine title and to go back. But if it's a question of redacting any of this information on a document that might have been filed 10 years ago, of course, you got to go back through that and find it and then redact it. Same questions: at what cost, how long does it take? And I think there's probably an additional question, and that is whether or not you can effectively alter an official record. As I've already mentioned, I guess getting closer to our concern, we get this on a daily basis in most cases. We're talking about a lot of transactions, by the way. I mean, I did ask Jen Coleman, who she identified herself as recently which is probably a medium-sized county, I guess, in Oregon terms. And, you know, you're probably getting 250 documents that would relate to title on a daily basis. Many more, obviously, if you're in Washington or Multnomah County, we're probably talking on a yearly basis hundreds of thousands of documents. So, you know, the whole process of going back and screening these is not a simple one. But if, for example, there are some collateral issues as it relates to us. If, for example, we can't get information within a reasonable period of time, a couple of things of significance happen, at least a couple of things. One, we are required by state law to have in order to have a compliant title plan, which is what we have to have in order to write policies, it has to be current to 15 days. And so if it takes any longer than that, we have non-compliant plans according to state statutes and regulations that emanate from the insurance code. And I think then the most serious thing is that if we can't get the information to essentially do an appropriate search, we can't write title policies. And if we don't write title policies, conveyancing just doesn't occur. And so I think sort of quick and dirty, that those are our concerns about this language. We obviously would be delighted to sit down and talk to the to the DAs. There has not been any previous conversation, and in order to see if we can maybe more specifically define the nature of the problem, and once we've done that, see if we can come up with a solution that might make some sense. With that, I'd obviously be happy to entertain any questions, or Mr. Abbey would be happy to delve down several more levels on a technical basis than I probably can.
Well, Mr. Snyder, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll have to see if there's any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And first, I'd like to say that the deputy district attorneys and the public safety officers, those are our folks. And those are people that we are just as interested in protecting, and their spouses and their families, as anyone else is, maybe even more so. The assessors, the tax collectors, and the county clerks are also our folks. And they've raised a number of concerns, and we worked through those issues last legislative session with the public safety officers. In those discussions, the public safety officers narrowed their concerns to the situations that seem to be the most likely opportunities for people of ill will to do harm to either these employees or members of their family. And we excluded the other situations, recognizing that there might be some that would be problematic if somebody really, really, really wanted to get into it. Unfortunately, when we went through that process, we had some miscommunication with our own ranks. And when I thought we had some agreement, it turns out that we didn't, and not the best result occurred. But ultimately, I think it worked out well in the sense that we were appreciative and continue to be appreciative of the efforts on the part of the public safety officers last legislative session to focus their attention on where the greatest problems seem to lie. And the district attorneys were added later on in the legislative session along with the assistant attorneys general. The provisions in existing law that would continue to apply in this printed bill to public safety officers would no longer apply to the deputy district attorneys and the assistant attorneys general. In addition to that, the records that are identified in the existing law, which are voters' registration records and assessment and taxation records, would be substantially expanded to include any public record in the hands of any public agency. And we would invite a dialogue with the district attorneys to identify as much as possible where the real problem areas are and then focus our attention on those. Because as the law is drafted, the safeguards that are in existing law would no longer be available to those who handle those public records. And it would cover a whole host of other things. It would include building permits. It would include the records of school districts, of cities, of counties, of special districts. It could include any kind of communication. It would take out the exception for government-to-government purposes. And I'm not sure all those things are necessary in order to accomplish the results that the district attorneys want to achieve. So we would also recommend that we have a discussion about this and see if we can focus on the issues, and then as much as possible to make sure that the kinds of things that were described in the testimony of the two district attorneys don't happen.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Mr. Harkleroad, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm an attorney in private practice. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. For those of you who I don't... I'm sorry, Doug Harkleroad.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry, Chair Barker. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney and spent 34 years prosecuting cases, about 24 of those as District Attorney, and recently retired on December 31st. And so I have some significant personal knowledge about this situation. First, I want to reiterate, this applies to about 500 individuals, but maybe even significantly fewer than that, because I'm confident some of them won't make the request. And they have to make a request of the public body before anything happens. So they're going to have to do that personally, each and every deputy DA or attorney general that the attorney or deputy attorney general that the attorney general says. So it's a very small number of people. At the risk of showing my ignorance on title policies, but having read a few in the past, there's all kinds of exclusions in those things, and I suspect they could probably figure out how to write an exclusion that would take care of this problem should it arise, although I suspect it would be few and far between, because any deputy DA or DA or assistant attorney general who wanted to make a transaction go is certainly going to waive whatever confidentiality is applied so that they can make the transaction go. This is an employee safety issue, in my mind. I had the privilege of being DA for a long time, and I also had the obligation to worry about those employees in the district attorney's office. Those people are pretty close to the first line defense. Obviously, our police officers are our first line defense out there, but they're pretty close to the first line defense in some very dangerous areas. And so we need to do what we can to protect them. If it means bulletproof glass in your front entryway in a dangerous world these days, then that's what it means. If it means that we have to have courthouse security and airport-style security, so be it. The older police officers and people in courthouse, we all remember when we just used to come and go for free without those issues. It's a dangerous world. So we need to do what we can to put barriers in the way of bad guys who may want to hurt our first-line defenders. And you've heard some pretty graphic examples that I won't repeat, but I have. I do want to say two things. Many years ago, as district attorney, my phone rang in the middle of the night, and I got really worried when that individual started talking about my barn. How in the world did that individual know about my barn? Now, we did some work, and we found out who that person was, and some police officers and investigators talked to that person. I never had a problem again, but I immediately went to an unlisted phone number. Believe me, if this statute would have been in place at that time that's being proposed, I would have been doing that too. At the time, I had young children. So that was certainly a worry. Another time, a number of years later, I got a phone call from the psychiatrist at the Department of Veterans Affairs in Roseburg. And he said, Doug, I feel obligated to tell you that one of our patients here has threatened your life. And so I thought I'd better call you up and tell you that. And I said, well, how long is he committed for? And he said, oh, no, he's a voluntary patient. He can walk out any time. So that caused us to get photographs and get those around the office and certainly take them home. And you worry at what level you should tell your spouse about those sorts of things. everybody in law enforcement has had that experience, and I know there's several on this committee. I can tell you when that happened, had this statute been in effect, I would have gone to block that information. Why? Because it provides a barrier. It provides a barrier, and it provides a little bit more safety for those first-line defenders. The last thing I would say is that in that case that District Attorney Alex Gardner described for you in excellent detail, I was still in the office at that time, and that lawyer was afraid. I spent time talking to that lawyer. He was afraid. There wasn't too much that we could do, but we did spend taxpayer money to put a security system in his house. I thought that was the least we could do to try to protect him. And so we did that. I'd encourage you to look at the risk to those first-line defenders and pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Ms. Stigler.
Yeah. Chair Barker, and I don't know if this is appropriate for here or if I, it's appropriate to ask Ms. Sybil a question. It's more technical on the, I think, on the...
We could ask Ms. Sybil.
Okay. Thank you. As Sybil. And just to be clear for the record, I probably have a conflict in this situation as I'm married to the district attorney in Deschutes County who happened to be the subject of one of the incidents that Mr. Berry described. But at any rate... As I'm reading the way the proposal is written right now, if a request is made, it's not a blanket request. It's a request that's made of a particular public body, correct? So the request goes to a specific public body.
I believe that's the case.
Okay.
Yes. And it's not just a blanket.
It's not just a blanket. I want to be real clear on that because as things sort of were devolving here today, it made it sound like once a request is made, period, it was this giant blanket request. So it would be, as I'm reading the way it's proposed here, it's in the records of any public body that has received the specific request. So it is incumbent then upon, for instance, mm-hmm. if Mr. Harkle Road was going to make that request, that he would have to do it of a particular body.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. Thank you. And I guess I would just encourage us, Mr. Chair, if I might, if we're, since this isn't ready for a work session today, that, you know, we see what can be worked out, and not to lose the essence, I think, of what is being requested here, because as I think as several people have indicated, it's a serious, as Representative Shields indicated, it's an important issue here, and it's a serious matter. This isn't triviality.
Representative Olson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harker, I'm curious your take on the Internet. I'm stunned at going on Googling and finding my own name and how many other people I can find today. It's pathetic.
Put your phone number in.
Well, my take on the Internet is that there is lots of information out there about you, me, and everybody else in this room, probably. You're all elected officials, and so you're all over the Internet. And I don't see how to deal with that effectively. The argument being that, well, if it's all there, maybe that restricting the public bodies doesn't do anything. The answer is that the barrier to the information by the bad guys in this bill slows them down. Does it stop them? No. Uh-uh. And the Internet is a place to get lots of information.
Okay, thank you.
And I probably should have asked this of Jack and the others, but it really seems to me that the damage that of not being able to get the title search done would inure to the person who is the deputy district attorney and the assistant attorney general, not to any of the businesses who would be engaged in it. So I think the liability issue needs to be finessed perhaps a little bit. I don't know if the county should be legally liable if they can't block every single aspect, but it seems to be a good bill if we can salvage this and get it out of here.
And just I have one other question slightly off topic here. You and others have testified the district attorneys are on the front lines. People in lottery are considered police and fire for PERS. The legislator at one time was considered police and fire for PERS. Are the district attorneys and deputy district attorneys considered police and fire?
No.
Thank you. I change that, but there's no money.
Chair Barker, I have asked Mr. Snyder here in the room for many years to make that happen, and he's not done it.
This is a bad year to ask. Thank you. Mr. Berry, did you have something you wanted to add?
Thank you. Again, for the record, I'm Brad Berry, Yamhill County DA. Chair Barker and members of the committee, I wanted to respond to Representative Olson's comment about Internet access. And yes, I acknowledge there's a lot of information out on the Internet. There's two things that are important to note. Much of the information on the Internet, your personal information, comes from public record. So this may be a long process to increase protection day by day, year by year, and as new individuals come online as deputy DAs. Secondly, what we cannot do with our county clerk records or our assessor's records, I can do with Zaba Search or other search engines by requesting that my information be pulled from access, and they will honor that. I don't have that option with the clerk's records.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I hope the groups can get together and see if there is some workable solution to it.
I did earlier.
Yes,
I did. Nelson, no, wait. Nelson.
Okay. I don't know. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2103.
House Bill 2103 would require a DNA sample from every person who's arrested for a felony. Currently, you are only required to give a DNA sample if you have been convicted of a felony. Again, we do not have a fiscal impact statement.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer and Ms. Meyer. The Meyer girls.
You ought to see Heidi's house.
This is his mother's bill.
Lots and lots of guns.
Actually, poor guy.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I am very disappointed that former Representative Donna Nelson is not here to speak on her bill, but I am here today to speak against this bill. It's been a few years since I've talked about DNA collection, but I have done so over the many years. And the collection of DNA samples does have legitimate and vital medical, scientific, and forensic purposes, and research can lead to treatment and even cures for many genetic conditions. It can prove that an individual was at a crime, it can prove that an individual was not at the crime, and it can prevent innocent people from being incarcerated or can in fact lead to exoneration after incarceration. As I note, the Innocence Project has now over 232 post-conviction DNA exonerations, so it is indeed a powerful tool. But the vast amount of information that can be gleaned from DNA and the longevity of the samples and the ease to which databases can be shared do raise grave privacy, equality, and due process concerns to the ACLU. DNA has often been touted as sort of a high-tech fingerprint, but I think that's a very dangerous mistake because a fingerprint is for identification purposes and it will only attach to that individual. But DNA can provide a whole host of information about a person's ethnicity, family relationship, family history, likelihood of getting some 4,000 genetic conditions and diseases, and it does not just disclose the information about that individual, but also their family members. Geneticists are constantly increasing the information that can be gleaned from DNA, and some even claim that there are genetic markers for criminal tendencies, substance abuse, and so on. And so the possibilities for danger are endless. Now, I feel like for the lawyers and for the law enforcement, for everyone on this committee, sort of saying this is one of the central tenets, of our criminal justice system is the presumption of innocence until proven guilty. Seems something that I do not need to say. We all know that. But we do believe that taking a DNA sample from a person who has not been convicted of a crime does turn that proposition on its head. Thousands of people are arrested and detained every year and never charged with a crime. But allowing DNA samples from such persons to be uploaded in the state criminal database fundamentally alters the meaning and purpose of the database one from crime deterrence to population surveillance. The Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution and Oregon's counterpart, which is Article 1, Section 9, limits the power of government to search a person, and it's intended to establish a zone of personal integrity in which the government cannot intrude absent a compelling interest. There is no question that taking a DNA sample constitutes a search. And we should not lose sight of the fact that law enforcement already has the tools upon arresting someone, which is simply to get a court order. The Oregon courts have upheld the current law that is on the books, which allows for the DNA collection of individuals who've been convicted of felonies and a number of misdemeanors. However, the key rationale for the court in that case was the diminished expectation of privacy that a person who has been convicted has. That's not the same for someone who's been arrested. In addition to the fundamental principles of our justice system and the privacy issues, expanding Oregon's database to arrestees is at best impractical and perhaps impossible. Laboratories across the nation here in Oregon are facing backlogs. I believe you have a statement from the Oregon State Police. They will talk about the fact that they had 25,000 backlog DNA samples from the current law until there was an infusion of over $1 million in the 2007 session, and they estimate that this will cost around over $800,000 for 09 to 11 and onward. So it has a huge cost in here in Oregon. I think it interesting that Dr. Samuel Bechtel, forensic examiner of the DNA analysis unit of the FBI laboratory, said, "Personally, I cannot imagine doing DNA typing on every person who is arrested or even every person who is indicted. People that suggest these things have probably not been near the local crime lab in a long time. We have our hands full just handling the cases going to trial and getting the evidence out there to either exclude or include someone." As of March 2003, the National Institutes of Justice estimated that more than 350,000 rape and homicide cases awaited DNA testing problems, and this would simply add to the problem and not help it. For all these reasons, and actually many more that I did not include in my testimony today, to keep it brief, ACLU urges this committee not to move forward with this proposal.
Thank you. And just before you say, I want to just say for the record that we have a email contact from a Mrs. Cochran of Dallas, Oregon, who's opposed to it also.
Chair? Yes. I've got to leave, but it brings tears to my eyes when I agree with Andrea.
Krieger, so many folks have been saying that this
it's
session.
Good.
it doesn't bring tears to my eyes, but
I'll recover by Monday.
Ms. Myers, I was trying to get former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to come in and discuss the Fourth Amendment, but he wasn't available.
He's been secreted away to some place that we don't know.
Please,
thank you. Chair Barker and members of the committee, my comments will be brief. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we would echo and join in the comments made by the ACLU and only note my comments will be addressed specifically to Section 8, which attempts to provide provisions to cleanse the database of samples and materials that ought not to be there because the arrest did not result in a conviction. I point out the following. In subsection B of Section 8, there would still be a lawyer, a court-appointed lawyer or a lawyer for the arrestee, on the scene in the event of a judgment of an acquittal after trial or a dismissal by the DA or a conviction that was reversed. There would still be a lawyer there on behalf of the arrested person that could follow through, make the petition to get those buccal samples out of the database again. But what of the individual where there was an arrest and no prosecution ever ensued? So with respect to subsection C, it says, you know, the sample needs to be in the database until if the prosecution is not commenced within the statute of limitations period for the crime of the arrest. Our statute of limitation provisions for felonies generally is 3 years, but there are multiple exceptions. Arson, it's 6 years. Sex abuse cases, it's 6 years. But if the victim is under the age of 18, then any time before the victim reaches 30 years. My point being, by then, there's no appointed counsel around. We'll never get anyone to petition on behalf of the arrestee to get those samples back out of the database.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. This had nothing to do with this, and this is back on House Bill 2339. I had a constituent who's county counsel in Deschutes County who had written me an email that I promised, though I don't share her point of view, I promised that I would distribute that email to the committee members.
Thank you.
And neglected to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Myers. No further business before the committee. Committee's adjourned. Have a good weekend.